Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is the transportation-based needs and impacts of fracking-based energy extraction. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing the audio over the computer as well. Today we'll have three presenters: Dr. Cesar Quiroga of the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, Mark Murawski of the Lycoming County, Pennsylvania Planning Commission, and Coral Torres of the FHWA Office of Freight Management and Operations. Mark Murawski has been the transportation planner for Lycoming County for the past 27 years. He administers the Williamsport Area Metropolitan Planning Organization Transportation Planning Program. As part of Mark's duties, he is responsible for preparation and update of the Williamsport MPO Long Range Transportation Plan, Transportation Improvement Program, and has conducted numerous special studies on a wide variety of transportation issues. Mark currently serves on 17 transportation committees at the state, regional, and local levels, including chairman of the Williamsport Municipal Airport Authority, vice chairman of the Pennsylvania Aviation Advisory Committee, and a member of the Lycoming County Natural Gas Exploration Task Force. Cesar Quiroga is a senior research engineer at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. He is involved in a wide range of transportation research and technology transfer and implementation initiatives. Examples of focus areas include project development process optimization, utility relocation and permitting, and impact of energy developments on transportation systems. In particular, he has followed energy developments in Texas, including the Barnett Shale region and more recently, the Eagle Ford Shale region. Coral Torres is a transportation specialist with the FHWA Freight Management Office and manages several programs and projects such as the Peer-to-Peer Exchange Program, the Off-Hour Delivery Study, and the National Freight Network Designation. Coral started her career working as a highway designer and construction inspector for local and state agencies in Puerto Rico. She later became a research and teaching assistant at the University of Puerto Rico and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where she worked on several key projects, such as the Off-Peak Freight Deliveries to New York City project and Sustainable Freight Logistics Oakland, California case study. She later became one of the co-founders of the sustainable logistics company Green Guidance. Her career with the federal government started as a PDP highway engineer at the FHWA Georgia Division Office. She also served as the Highway Performance Monitoring System Size and Weight Program Manager and Temporary Everyday Counts Coordinator in the state of Pennsylvania, where she assisted in the development of the Straight Transportation Innovation Council, which FHWA has instituted as exemplary for other states. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area on the right side of your screen. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering the questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the questions typed into the chat box. The PowerPoint presentations used during today's webinar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript, and I'll notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, please have your name typed into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits. Today's webinar is not yet available on the AICP website, but I'll send out notice once it is. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for today, please note that FHWA does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive them for your participation if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive credits, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit it to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to please download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. So we'll now go ahead and get started with our first presenter, Dr. Cesar Quiroga of the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. So Cesar, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. I really appreciate it. And welcome everybody to this webinar. As you can see, the title of my presentation is Fracking-Based Energy Development and Transportation Impact on Needs. And what I would like to do this afternoon is to first of all, provide an answer to the question, what is hydraulic fracturing or fracking? Try to lay out the foundation for the identification of transportation impacts and end my presentation with a discussion on current initiatives and needs. Let me start with trying to define what is hydraulic fracturing. At a high level, hydraulic fracturing or fracking is really about fracturing rocks using fluid at high pressure. It usually involves using water mixed with sand and chemicals. The fracturing process in combination with the sand and chemicals results in small fractures on the rock that enable gas, petroleum, and water to migrate to the well. While fracking has been in the news for the last few years, the reality is that it is a combination of technologies, some of which have been around for quite a long time. Hydraulic fracturing, for example, has been around since the 1940s. I should also mention that there have been several initiatives over the years, including the Department of the Energy Eastern Gas Shelf Project, or EGSP, which was really about a set of research and demonstration projects that involved cost sharing with the industry. That was one of the enabling technologies, hydraulic fracturing. The second enabling technology was horizontal drilling. Horizontal drilling was rarely used until the late 1980s when it began to be used in the Austin Chalk Formation in Texas. And for those of you who are familiar with the Barnett Shale in North Texas, the first time it was used, the Barnett Shale was in 1991. The third enabling technology is what is called slick water fracturing, which really is about using chemicals in combination with water to increase fluid flow. This slick water technology was introduced in 1996, 1997 timeframe, and it began to be used to develop shale gas shale formation at that point, or primarily in connection with the Barnett Shale. So really, when we talk about fracking, we're talking about several technologies, horizontal drilling, both slickwater fracturing, and the combination of these technologies has made the extraction of shale gas efficient and therefore feasible. Just to give an idea of what this looks like, really this is a schematic that you can find on the Department of the Energy's website. You can see there is a vertical well that then is reconfigured or changes into a horizontal direction. While the typical depth is between 5 and 10,000 feet, you have to keep in mind that shale formations are usually not very thick, only 200 to 400 feet. But the horizontal laterals can be anywhere from 5,000 to 6,000 feet or even more. This is very important to keep that in mind when I talk about water, the use of water for hydraulic fracturing, because it is the length of these laterals that really make the difference in terms of the amount of water that is needed for fracking. And just to provide a little bit of perspective, in 2012, there were 1 million fracking jobs in the U.S. In 2010, in fact, 60% of all new wells drilled worldwide used fracking. So this is really a technology that is here to stay. According to EIA estimates, it is estimated that crude oil will probably stay within the 6 to 10 million barrels a day for the next 30 years, but natural gas is quite likely to increase anywhere from below 20 to upwards of 30 trillion cubic feet per year, depending on projection. The EIA is, of course, updating these estimates every year. And just to give you an idea of what we're able for shale formation in South Texas, this is a formation, this is the shale that was, that the discovery well was developed in back in 2007-8. It's 350 barrels a day in 2008, but in 2012 it has grown to 387,000 barrels a day, and this year, as of May, it has grown to 564,000 barrels a day. So clearly, this is a growth industry. So that's in terms of the first part. It's attempting to provide an answer to the question, what is hydraulic fracturing and fracking, and just to wrap it up, remember, hydraulic fracturing is technology that has been around for decades, but in combination with horizontal drilling and the use of chemicals is really the combination of these technologies that has resulted in the massive use of what we now call just fracking. Let me switch gears and talk about transportation efforts. And to put things in perspective, let me use as an example a gas well from the Barnett Shale in North Texas. Developing a well really requires a lot of truckload. For example, in this particular situation, there were almost 200 truckloads for site preparation, rig mobilization, drilling operations, and removal of the rig. And then you need close to 1,000 truckloads for parking, which corresponds to an assumption of almost 4 million gallons of 88,000 barrels of water for fracking and for salt water disposal. But that's not the end of the story, because then you need a significant amount of truckloads every year for maintenance, and you might need to do refracking. Now, of course, this is speculation, but this is just to give you an idea that after the well is developed is not the end of the story. The number of truckloads really is a function of a number of factors, including well type and depth, geology, drilling technology, and as I mentioned, the water needs for fracking can vary substantially. In the literature, you might find references anywhere from 2 to 6 million gallons of water. But keep in mind that what really made the difference was the use of horizontal wells. So for example, in the Marcellus Shale, I found a reference that when there was a vertical well, there was hydraulic fracturing done on that. You might need anywhere from 20,000 to 80,000 gallons for the fracking operation, whereas if you were doing horizontal well fracking, you would need anywhere from 2 to 9 million gallons of water. So, now that we have an understanding of all the truckloads, now the question is, what is the impact? And the impacts can be quite significant. We can look at these impacts from a variety of points of view. And I'm just going to touch base on the pavement impacts, on-site impacts, and operational safety impacts. So let me start with pavement impacts. We have, many of you may have seen pictures everywhere related to damage of roadways. I'm just going to show you a couple of slides documenting pavement shoving a lot of surface. This one was on Interstate 35, Furnish Road, south of Dallas, south of Fort Worth, sorry. This one is west of Fort Worth, and I have a number of other pictures, from West Texas, South Texas, County Road, Buffalo Road, etc. And so the question is, how do we quantify that? Well, let me show you the results of an analysis we completed a couple of years ago, in which we used a GPR, or a noise interferometer, on a number of segments throughout Texas, really West Texas and north from the Barnett Shale. And ignoring for a second that there are two computer models here, it's just an indication that when we looked at the numbers, we concluded that 50 to 60% of the pavement structures for these segments were expected to have less than 5 years of remaining life. So that's quite significant. And one of the things we did then was to try to estimate the pavement life. We developed a couple of tools to do this. For those of you who are familiar with the energy development industry, you need to dispose of the salt water, and you need facilities, especially injection wells for that. So many of these injection wells are permitted according to the maximum number of barrels they can receive per day. So if you were to look at any number, for example, 20,000, you can translate that into the number of truckloads you can receive per day, per year, compare that to diesels, and if you're familiar with pavement design, you know that different types of facilities can be designed for different types of people. So if you assume a rural road, a farm-to-market road, and assuming that it is new, at this rate, 20,000 barrels a day, well, this facility might not have more than 4 years of life, assuming it was new when the process started. This is definitely not the case. One other thing we did as an example was the estimate of impact statewide. We produced a high level estimate here in the state, and it was about $1 billion a year on the state roads. Taking into consideration the local and county roads account for roughly the same amount of damage, we came up with an estimate of about $2 billion a year, which is quite significant. There were several assumptions. We had to make assumptions regarding the buffer around which we assumed impact. We then include U.S. Ohio border facilities and bridges that didn't include that. So, if anything, that impact would be higher than the number I just mentioned. A very important fact to keep in mind is that you might have overweight loads. And just to give you an idea of how important the overweight factor is, if you look at 80,000 pounds as the reference, if you were to increase an overload, to 100,000 miles, the increase in weight is only 20%, but the increase in impact is 240%. So it is quite significant. It's something that we should not forget. Now let me switch gears really quickly to other effects. Let me talk about for a second about roadside impact. And there are many. You have issues related to driveway access and permitting, including accommodation and permitting, for example, related to crossings, when there's an installation, gathering lines, temporary lines, easement issues, and so on. Access and permitting is an important issue. And just to illustrate this point, this is a facility access to a saltwater facility. And notice here, this is a two-way roadway that has no shoulders. And even though the turning radius is more than adequate, notice the damage to the shoulder structure on the left, and then on the right, notice fire tracks and safety entrances. So this is a significant issue. And notice in this case that the access to the facility was paved, which is not always the case. Like in this situation, where the access to the energy development was by using an existing farm driveway. And notice that there was really no improvement or otherwise treatment done to the drainage. So every time it rains, this is what you end up with. There are many other impacts, operational and safety. It has been documented, for example, here I live in San Antonio, very close to the Eagle Port, and when the increase in truck traffic became evident, one of the first results of that was a significant increase in the number of crashes and fatalities. So it is a significant issue. You can document this in using other types of data, for example, commercial vehicle safety violations. And remember the impact that I mentioned regarding overweight? Well, it turns out that a significant number of violations pertain to exceeding the maximum standard axle weight, in this case 34,000 pounds. And notice that energy-related traffic is ranked higher than non-energy-related traffic. So it is an important issue. Let me try to summarize some of these issues in terms of things that are happening at the moment. I think nationwide is an increasing level of awareness. When you talk to stakeholders, county roads, the county officials, local officials, et cetera, it generally depends. The focus is still, at least in the eyes of the public, still mainly on environmental and water issues. And so one of the needs I see is to continue to increase awareness about the impact on transportation infrastructure. Because you could see from the numbers I mentioned earlier, is a significant issue. The number of state and local efforts. You know, everywhere you find trucking activities, you know, Arkansas, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, you name it, there is continuous reference to activities, for example, in the form of virtual conferences and so on. So most of these efforts tend to be isolated. There's very little on the national front in terms of national conferences. I could perhaps mention that in the past TRB annual meeting this year, we had a couple of sessions. There was a workshop, there was a paper session. There were a couple other sessions that mentioned impact of energy development and transportation infrastructure. I could also mention an upcoming conference in 2014. ASAE is sponsoring a Shale Energy Engineering Conference, or SEEC, which will take place in Pittsburgh. For those of you who would be interested in giving presentations at the conference, at the end I'm going to provide my contact information, so please, I encourage you to let me know, and we will find a way to add you to the program. In terms of needs, there is a need for a national research agenda. Remember, most of the activities that have taken place have taken place at the local and regional, some state level. But there is very little at the national level in terms of setting a comprehensive, robust research agenda to address this set of issues. There is an upcoming NCHRP synthesis project that will attempt to look at some of these practices, but again, it's not a formal or otherwise a significant research project. There is a need for documentation of case studies, best practices in a number of areas, communication and coordination with the industry. There is an increasing level of recognition that the earlier agencies begin coordinating with the industry, the better everybody will be. I can tell you, share with you that KDOTs frequently only learn about a energy development, at least officially, when the request for a driveway permit comes in. By then, it's too late. I think the time to start formation is when the industry is beginning with the leasing efforts, with the drilling permits and so on. There is a need to document best practices regarding to phasing repair, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. Look at what people are doing in terms of operations and safety. Roadside management, access, driveway permits, and so on. And of course, take a look at laws and regulatory frameworks, because what may be working in one state might not necessarily work in other states because the law and regulatory framework is different. Now, other needs, for example, in terms of transmission planning. The work we've done has only started to scratch the surface in terms of what the supply chains are. And what I'd like to highlight is that there is a need to document supply chains at different geographic levels, depending on what analysis you're interested in. So it's not just supply chain at the state level, for example, but also at the regional, even local level, so that you can understand the impact on how you can prepare for that. There are implications regarding regional metropolitan planning, and there is a need to document best case, case studies and best practices. And don't forget, we're talking about really multimodal considerations. It's not just about truck dollars. It's also about rail. In many situations, rails constitute a significant component of energy development, ports and waterways, and of course, international ports. And I shouldn't forget environmental issues. At the end of the day, emissions and air quality is a very strong driving force. And of course, as a result, you know, it drives the conversation when it comes down to regional metropolitan planning. Let me just close this presentation by showing you a time lapse of the Barnett Shale. And this is just to illustrate those assumptions of uniform growth rates per year, you know, 2 or 3% per year uniformly, really don't apply to this. And pay attention to the lower right corner of your screen here in Johnson County. And this is the situation that was in 2001. Notice here in gray, the location of the permits that existed up to that point. And what I'm going to do is click in, and then you will see how all of a sudden the number of permits, primarily dry gas in Johnson County, increased. And so for this type of situation, there's really no validity in the assumption of a uniform 2 to 3% growth per year. And that's about it. Here is my contact information. If you need any additional information, here it is. You know, feel free to contact me by email or by phone. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Caesar. And I do encourage everybody, if you do have any questions for Caesar, to please continue to type them into the chat area, and we'll get to them after all of the presentations. Our next presentation will be given by Mark Morawski of the Lycoming County Planning Commission. So, Mark, you can go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. We're going to be talking today about our local experiences related to natural gas drilling in the Marcellus play. And we'll be covering all modes of transportation in terms of what kind of impacts we are seeing here. Just as a bit of background, where we're situated, Lycoming County is one of 67 counties in the state of Pennsylvania. We are about 3.5 hour drive to the west would be Pittsburgh, and another 3.5 hour southeast is to Philadelphia. We are basically situated in north central Pennsylvania. Williamsport is the county seat, but perhaps worldwide we're best known as the home of Little League Baseball, in which we annually host the Little League World Series each August. The other thing, what Little League is not going on here, traditionally we have been a very sleepy town. So those folks who remember the Andy Griffith Show and Mayberry RFD, that little town, well, you could say that Williamsport sort of was like Mayberry RFD. That is until the Marcellus gas drilling activity started happening. Now we are the seventh fastest growing city in the United States because of Marcellus. In terms of the discovery, Lycoming County officials first became aware of the potential of the Marcellus gas play in the spring of 2008. How we found this out was purely by accident. We had a call from our county register recorder's office to our commissioner's office one day saying that there was a sudden influx of customers who wanted to record land deeds and they had cowboy hats and boots on, and they talked with a southern accent, and they didn't understand what was going on. So our commissioners started making inquiries about why they were here, and they said they were landmen who were coming up from the south, who were starting the process of assembling land leases to drill for natural gas as a part of this Marcellus. So the commissioners knew at that point there was something huge going on here, and they needed to learn more about it. The other thing about this, once we started getting into it, the Lycoming County commissioners had adopted a comprehensive plan, and the local MPO here had a long-range transportation plan done with it in 2007. And at that time, there was really no mention of Marcellus gas exploration or transportation impacts because we really they weren't known at that point. So once these plans, which got a state award, by the way, were completed and adopted, the very next year when gas drilling took root here, they were already outdated. So all this does is it tells all of us in the planning world that when you're developing a plan, you need to make sure that it's flexible so that you can adapt to changing circumstances. That could be a huge transformation or game changer in your region. So we are in the process now of updating these plans to take into account the Marcellus experience. This map on your screen shows the extent of the Marcellus play. As you will note that this gas play is the largest natural gas find in the United States right now and second largest globally. It stretches across a large portion of Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, Ohio, and Maryland. And the U.S. Geological Survey estimates the formation's total area to be around 95,000 square miles. It ranges in a depth of 4,000 to 8,000 feet, containing more than 410 trillion cubic feet of natural gas that supplies the nation's energy needs. Under that, you will see the Utica Shale, which is another layer in the cake, if you will, of energy development, which has promising oil reserves in it. So after the Marcellus play is well cultivated, the Utica is another opportunity that could come to light. Our boom here, and it was similar to the gold rush, really, in 1849 to California, but our boom started in October 2007, very small, actually. Just a couple wells were drilled in the county, the first one being in Cogan House Township in October 2007. Now, we have a rich history of energy development in Lycoming County, but it was mainly attributable about 100 years ago to the lumbering boom. And also development of coal. Lycoming County is the largest county in Pennsylvania, geographically speaking, and we are actually bigger than the state of Rhode Island. Now, with that kept in mind, approximately 60% of the county's total land area is now currently under a land lease for natural gas exploration, which comprises over 691 square miles. So this is a very vast area we're talking about. Now, during the past 6 years, natural gas drilling skyrocketed from just a few wells in 2007, where by 2012, we actually had the highest number of Marcellus horizontal wells drilled of any of the 40 counties in Pennsylvania where Marcellus exists. So we are now the leader in Marcellus gas development. Because of this, and also our neighbors to the north, which include Bradford, Tioga, Sullivan, Susquehanna, and Clinton counties, we have now are seeing several thousand wells drilled over a multi-county area, and it's basically changing the everyday aspects of life throughout the entire region. So it's not just limited to transportation impacts. It covers housing and environmental and just a whole host of things. Now, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection basically maintains an updated database on the names and locations of well sites. And then our County Department of Public Safety also has a database where we actually address each of the wells for 911 emergency response because a lot of these wells are situated in remote areas. So basically, we've had 775 wells drilled to date, and we're looking at another permitted amount of 329 wells through DEP. So these can be coming online soon. This map shows our county, and the dots you see are where the well locations are at this point. Williamsport is sort of at the center of the map where the main highway systems converge, and they also traverse the Susquehanna River. Now, the way the geology is in Lycoming County, there are really no Marcellus wells being drilled south of the Susquehanna River. It's all north. And this is very mountainous terrain, a lot of it's state forest land, and it's different than a lot of other gas plays throughout the United States, such as Barnett or Eagle Ford or Bakken up in North Dakota. We have a lot of mountainous terrain. It's not flat, so it also presents transportation challenges because these roads, although they were never really built to handle this heavy truck traffic, they also have a lot of curvature in them, steep slopes and things that make truck traffic very difficult to navigate through this remote area. This slide shows a compressor station. We have 40 such compressor stations now built in Lycoming County. And for those of you who don't know, compressor stations, what they do is they compress natural gas by pumping up its pressure, and it provides this energy to move the gas through the next section of a pipeline network. So think of compressor stations as an engine that powers natural gas movement through a series of pipelines to market. And a lot of our gas is going, obviously, to serve the northeastern United States. This shows a gathering line that is being constructed on one of the mountainous terrain areas that I had spoke of earlier. These gathering lines comprise right now of construction of hundreds of miles that connect the well sites to the main trunk lines that take the gas to market. And this map shows basically the overall large pipeline system traversing Pennsylvania. We are located on the Transco line. They're going that red line through the center of the state. So the well sites have the gathering lines built to connect to the main Transco line. The line that's sort of in purple to the north of us through Tioga and Bradford counties is the Tennessee Valley line, another main east-west line where some of our gathering lines are also connecting. We created a task force back in 2008. We were the first county to do so in Pennsylvania. And basically what it was to try to gather research, identify issues related to natural gas drilling. We are not a regulatory body. This task force does not create laws or regulations over the gas industry. We have 18 members on the task force. You'll see the different areas on the slide that we represent. We try to be broad-based to cover all the major stakeholders in our community that are affected by this. And we have 7 separate subcommittees that look at specific areas of issue and then report back. This task force also, back in 2008, decided to go to Texas and in Tarrant County is where they visited, and to learn about the Barnett Shale experience that Caesar spoke of earlier. Now, the basic requirements, kind of similar to what Caesar went over, the Marcellus experience, and these are data by our State Department of Transportation. Each well pad typically uses about 3 to 5 acres of land with 6 to 8 wells per pad. The pad development is done over a 4 to 6 week period. And we have 5,000 tons of aggregate needed to construct the pads, and that generates 300 to 400 truck trips to do that. Then you have the actual well drilling that occurs, which requires more equipment, water, and cement. And that generates another 150 to 200 truck trips over a 4 to 5 week period. Then the third stage is the fracking, where we're actually taking up the natural gas deposits. That takes another 800 to 1,000 truck trips, transporting 3 to 6 million gallons of water and frack sand over another 1 to 2 week period. So at the end of the day, per pad, you're looking at 2 to 3 months of development with 1,250 to 1,600 cumulative truck trips over roads that maybe only had 100 or 200 vehicles a day on them previously. So obviously, with the road impacts we're looking at, 2/3 of our road system in Lycoming County is locally owned by different municipalities, not the state of Pennsylvania. The other third is owned by the state. And again, many of these roads were not built to accommodate heavy hauling activity. The Pennsylvania law, which is the Motor Vehicle Code, basically sets forth the process to establish weight limits on roads and to bond these roads where the heavy hauler has to make financial improvements to upgrade the roads to the road owner specification. Now, the county, what we do, since we don't really own the roads as county government, we work with PennDOT and the local municipalities to educate them on the proper way of posting and bonding roads so it can be legally enforced for any violations. And we do that through our local technical assistance program training series. For the most part, gas companies are doing a good job making the necessary repairs to local roads. We've had some isolated issues, but they're not a very big concern. And another concern we have is the accelerated deterioration to our life cycle payments on roads that are not bonded. So who's going to pay that bill? In Pennsylvania, basically, transportation funding is derived from the gas tax at the state level. And then there is now an Act 13 fee that I'll speak to later that provides more revenue. But we have no comprehensive database on the condition of local roads. We do on the state road system. This gives you an example of some of the road damage we've seen up in our county to the north in the first year of drilling before they did winter maintenance plans. So Lycoming County never saw this kind of damage, but we learned from our neighboring counties, got winter maintenance plans in place with the gas companies so that we keep our roads in a good state of repair. Just mentioning, some roads went from 150 vehicles a day to just 700 trucks per day. So that's been quite a challenge. This map shows all of the posted roads in Lycoming County right now that are on the state road system. We do not have a database of the local roads. They all, each municipality handles that on their own. But about half of our roads, state roads, are load posted. We've had impacts on local bridges as well. We have about a total of 100 locally owned bridges over 20 feet long, and 25% of these bridges are structurally deficient. We have another 100 locally owned bridges between 8 and 20 feet long, and 35% of those bridges are structurally deficient. And I should point out that Lycoming County is the only county in Pennsylvania that actually did a pilot where we identified locally owned bridges and are actually inspecting them. No county in Pennsylvania has a similar inspection program on locally owned bridges 8 to 20 feet long. But the feds do not require that. It's some optional because gas traffic has been riding over these bridges and we want to keep them safe. Just in terms of briefly on some other transportation modes, our transit provider is River Valley Transit. They are in the process of converting their entire transit fleet to natural gas. It's about 30 buses. And they're developing a CNG fast fuel station at their transportation hub. So this should be online this fall, and it shows that we're using local uses for the gas underneath our feet. At the airport, similar things we've seen. Right now, we only have U.S. Airways serving the airport and provides 3 daily flights to Philadelphia International. And since gas took effect, we are now seeing 50% of all of our commercial passenger traffic related to gas. Our planes are full, and about 60% of our corporate aviation traffic is Marcellus related as well. So we've seen a 44% increase in our commercial passenger traffic since gas started. And you look at other airports across the northeastern United States during the same period, they're seeing their traffic fall. As a result of this, we really are trying to get more direct air service beyond Philadelphia. We are negotiating with airlines now for direct service to Washington, D.C., Charlotte, Chicago, and Orlando. This would help better address Marcellus customer needs since they're not too nuts about going to Philadelphia Airport. And we're also in the process of replacing our airport terminal building for $13.6 million so that we can grow and expand to meet the Marcellus needs. Our budget at the airport has definitely gone from the red to the black because we have a number of leases with gas tenants now to pay the rents to the airport authority, and they've invested over $7 million to improve airport property. The railroad impacts have been significant as well. We have a short line railroad called the Lycoming Valley Railroad. Right now, about 20% of their entire rail traffic is gas related, and this helps take the trucks off the road. But it's not a substitute because there still needs to be an interface point between rail and truck since the wells are in remote locations not served by rail. So truck traffic still has to happen there. You see a lot of types of Marcellus gas commodities are transported by rail, such as frac sand, the pipe, other kind of equipment related, and they come from a large swath of the United States. Our main transfer terminal point between rail and truck freight for anything, including Marcellus, is the Newberry Rail Yard, which is shown there. That rail yard is now operating at full capacity. when there was substantial vacancies there before Marcellus. And we just finished spending a $10 million Tiger II grant to upgrade our rail infrastructure to respond to the Marcellus demands. We use an impact fee that's approved by the state legislature. That gives Lycoming County and its local municipalities about $10 million to address these drilling impacts. But all $10 million is not devoted just exclusively to transportation needs. It competes with other types of community impacts and needs like water, sewer, public safety, et cetera. So it's a tool, but not really enough to deal with all the needs we have. So that's my presentation, and I'll turn it back over to Jennifer.
Well, thank you, Mark. Our final presentation will be given by Coral Torres of the FHWA Office of Freight Management and Operations. So Coral, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good afternoon to everyone. I just want to say thank you to Cesar and Mark for giving those really good presentations. They're truly the experts on the subject here, so I didn't want to take too much time going into detail about the subject. I did wanted to talk about a meeting that we had during June this past summer in relationship to this topic. And as a matter of fact, Mark was one of the presenters that we had participate in this meeting. So as you can see, Mark and Cesar both have really, really good information about the topic. I just wanted to talk about some of the most important takeaways that that we had from the meeting, and also to talk about the peer exchange program that we have here in our freight management office, our Federal Highway Freight Management Office, in case anyone is interested in taking advantage of that opportunity. So again, my name is Coral Torres, and I'm currently the program manager for the Freight Office Peer-to-Peer Program. Is it working here? All right. Thank you. So, as I was mentioning, the peer-to-peer program started about 5 years ago here in our freight management office. And the overall objective is to bring transportation professionals together with experts in the field and provide technical assistance in order to enhance overall freight skills and knowledge. All public entities that have any freight-related programs or any freight-related activities are welcome to apply to get assistance through this program. So we're talking about State Department of Transportation, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, Rural Planning Organizations, so on and so forth. Who can participate? As I mentioned, any public entity that has a freight-related program and has some sort of issue that we'd like to discuss with experts at the national level, it's encouraged to apply and participate through our program. What we have here, it's a list of some of our previous participants and requesting peers. So, for example, we had the Maryland Department of Transportation, the North Central Texas Council of Governments, the Port of Seattle. We've had regional planning commissions such as the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission, the Puget Sound Regional Council, so on and so forth. Even though private entities are not allowed to apply, we do encourage their participation in terms of bringing feedback and important information to share with our applicants and the other stakeholders that we will have in our meetings. So pretty much the areas of focus for the program are freight planning, programming, project development, operations, and policy. And throughout the past 5 years, we've been able to develop a series of different meetings. And what you can see here is just an example of some of the topics that we have or the agendas that we've been able to develop based on those five main general topics that we usually cover. So we've been able to develop and implement meetings in relationship to how to work with freight data, how to develop STIP and TIP plans, multi-jurisdictional planning efforts, vehicle size and weight issues, regional permitting, so on and so forth. And the last one we currently have, like I mentioned, was the one related to the impact of fracking on state and local roads. So we don't focus specifically on the list that we have here. Once the peer or the requesting peer submits their application, we just make sure that it complies or it's a good fit within the five main areas, focus areas that we have, and we manage to assist them with developing an agenda within those five focus areas. what do we provide with the program? We pretty much have three types of sessions that we can work with. We have the peer work sessions, in which is a combination of an informational session and some sort of educational exercise session as well. So we bring peers together, in which we have presentations and Q&A sessions, and then throughout the rest of the meeting, what we do is we usually put them to work. Like, for example, we had a meeting last year in which the Pennsylvania DOT met with the Texas and Oklahoma DOT to talk about their permitting software. So they were able to travel to the Texas and Oklahoma DOT facilities to get to know more about the software, the program, the modifications they have to do according to the challenges within the region. And they were able to work with the staff and directly with the software. So they learned a lot, and they were able to bring those lessons back to, in order for them to update the system in Pennsylvania. We also have peer roundtables and workshops. This is more of an informational session in which we're going to have presentations and Q&A sessions in specific to one topic. And what we usually do is we try to develop a very comprehensive agenda in which each of the presenters, it's an expert on one of the specific elements of that issue in particular. So, for example, the meeting that we have in relationship to fracking, we had presenters from Wisconsin DOT, North Dakota DOT, Pennsylvania DOT, Pennsylvania State Police, some of the MPOs and RPOs in Pennsylvania and other regions of the country, New York as well. And all of them were able to present a specific element of the topic. Like, for example, we had MPOs and RPOs from Pennsylvania talking about how to incorporate the impacts of fracking into the planning process. We had some of the state DOTs talk about permitting and administration. The state police talked about enforcement and so on and so forth. And last but not least, we have the freight scans, which is or usually involves observing freight operations firsthand, allowing for greater understanding of operations and the possibility of implementing successful solutions elsewhere. So an example would be, we weren't able to do this during the fracking peer exchange because of we had a very packed agenda. But we were hoping, for example, to go to one of the fracking wells to look at the operations, get a better sense of what the level of truck traffic, the equipment they use on the wells is, in order to educate, you know, the peers, the requesting peers, and also the peers that, that were presenting during the meeting as well. Another example is we had a meeting in Memphis earlier this year, and we were able to, the topic was multi-jurisdictional coordination, and we were able to bring MPOs, state DOTs, as well as some private entities like FedEx, BNFS, and Canada Rail together to talk about the issues of the region in terms of infrastructure and operational challenges. And we were able to take tours of the FedEx hub at the Memphis airport and the BNFS intermodal facility in the Memphis area as well. And that was very informative for everyone. We were able to take a look at the operations and the challenges in terms of the infrastructure and the operations surrounding those facilities. So now I'm just going to talk briefly about some of the takeaways and the outcomes of the last meeting that we had, which the title was Impacts of Fracking Operations in State on State and Local Roads. As I mentioned, we had this meeting in Pennsylvania. One of the MPOs in New York was the requesting peer, and we were able to bring several stakeholders from around the nation to talk about different topics. Like I mentioned, we talked about the state perspective and the MPO perspective on the impacts of fracking on local and state roads, permitting and administration, enforcement, and also about coordination between all of the agencies. Pretty much for many states and local transportation agencies, the primary source of information related to fracking activities has been anecdotal. So this provided an opportunity for everyone to bring everyone together and actually hear from all of these public and private entities that have been directly affected by the natural gas and oil boom. So it was a very informative exercise. Like I mentioned, Mark was there. We have other similar presentations as what Cesar presented earlier. And it was very informative to all the parties involved. Some of the takeaways I just wanted to talk about, some of the other discussions that we have. I didn't want to cover too much information about what Mark and Cesar presented, but in terms of MPO and RPO perspective, it was very interesting when Mark and Amy Kessler, which she works also at the North Central region, one of the RPOs there, it was very interesting to hear how dynamic and fast this whole boom was for the region. We're talking about some very rural areas that, you know, these RPOs have very limited staff because of what the census has defined for them. And based on on what they get by formula defined by census and other criteria, they get very limited funding. So when this happened, it changed drastically, you know, the elements to what they have to work, and it brought a lot of challenges to the planning and the staff that work at this planning organization. So a lot of what we've heard was how much there was an increase in traffic volumes and congestion. We're talking about, you know, it might take you 15, 20 minutes to commute to work. Now we're talking about more than an hour, maybe 2 hours in a very small region. So that was definitely a challenge for the planners in terms of operations. We're talking about, you know, some of these regions don't even have traffic lights because they're in very rural areas. So how are they now going to deal with all of these issues and very limited funding, and how to take care of those issues in a very rapid manner? Wear and tear on the roads. You've seen the pictures that Mark and Cesar presented earlier. It's a very serious issue, you know, in terms of safety and operations. Like I said, you know, there's very limited funding for these entities to work with. So one very interesting thing that we've heard is that some of these companies do care about, you know, taking care of some of the roads, you know, that they're damaging. So one very interesting story that we heard is that some of the companies do invest money and do create the super highways because, you know, they invest their own money, so they just decide to follow pretty much their design standards. And now the issue for, you know, some of these planning organizations and state DOTs is how to maintain pretty much a super highway, a highway that has 2-3 times the thickness of what a usual pavement would have. That's a very high operational and maintenance budget that they have to deal with in the future to maintain such an infrastructure like that. Like I mentioned, you know, they're very limited with the staff that they have. So now we're talking about some of these RPOs only have one staff, one person, and this person is working part-time sometimes. So now they have a very high demand of issues that they have to deal with. So how can we fix this? This is a very serious and dynamic situation. And also the issues of, you know, safety in terms of truck traveling at high speeds on rural roads and inspection of local bridges, because a lot of these vehicles are overweight and oversized. So we managed to see that some states have created records of the state of some of the bridges and the roads, and they've been able to share that information with state DOTs. So some of the local entities have taken have come forward and started gathering information to share with the state DOTs to see if they can work together in some sort of way to take care of those bridges that are in really bad shape. In terms of permitting and administration, we've seen that there's a lot of these trucking companies that are not necessarily established in the state. They come from other states. So there might be a misconception about the laws and the regulations, because a lot of the oversized and overweight regulations do vary from state to state. So there's a huge challenge for the state DOTs and the local entities to educate these trucking companies that are transporting the machinery, the chemicals, and the water to the fracking wells. Evaluate your resources. The state DOT did mention that the demand of permits that they have to submit, it was quite drastic. So they did seek for assistance from the locals, and the locals also provide permits for these companies. And that's that's a way in which we can see collaboration, because it's going to be very difficult for one entity alone to take care or manage all of the issues involved with the impacts of the roads and permitting and enforcing. So that's one way we can see, you know, the different entities are collaborating, and they're also getting data about all of its types of different measures that they can later use to assess the situation. We happen to see how some of the DOTs simplify the permit application process by providing annual or blanket permits, because a lot of the private companies, they saw pushback from them, and that creates a lot of issues with citations and violations and breaking the law, and that's the last thing you want to see, you know, out there, you know, vehicles that are oversized and overweight, and they also don't, you see pushback from them in terms of complying with getting permits as well. So that's one way for them to keep track of the permits, and also they were coordinating with the state DOT as well in terms of violations and citations, because they want to keep track of how many companies are violating, you know, the permitting process or the oversized or an overweight regulations. So that's one way for them to establish metrics of in what areas this is occurring, where we should have more enforcement, what measures we can take for those companies that are recurrent violators, so on and so forth. So that's pretty much some of the main takeaways that we have from the meeting. Like I said, if anyone is interested in taking advantage of the program, it's open to public entities. We do have a list here of previous public entities and private entities that have participated, and we usually share that with our applicants in terms if they need assistance in terms of organizing the logistic of the meeting, get contact information. We provide all of that assistance to the requesting peers. So one of the benefits of the program is we do provide travel planning and reimbursement, like I mentioned. So we provide assistance with logistics in terms of coordinating all the travel for the people that will be presenting. If they need lodging, we will coordinate that as well. We do ask for the requesting peers to assist us in terms of finding a location to gather all the participants and have the meeting. But overall, it's we do take care of most of the incidentals and most of the planning process of the meeting. So if anyone is interested, well, before I get to the contact information, one of the things we do ask for is once you apply, we organize the agenda and we move forward with the meeting, we do ask for all the requesting peers to complete a final report. We usually keep a library of all of our meetings, and we usually post that information into our website. And we also develop flyers to share with our applicants and all other peers that are interested in a specific topic. And you can find that information as well in our website. So that's one of the requirements that we have for the program if you're interested in participating. So our contact information is here on this slide. The website has all the information in terms of how to apply and the application form. Once you complete the application form, you can submit it to freightpeerexchange@dot.gov. And that's all I have for today, if anyone has any questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Coral.